Shasvina Vadhitamastu Mavidvisha Bahaihi Om Shanti 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 Sarashiva Samarambham Sarashiva Samarambham Shankaracharya Madhyamam Shankara Asmaracharya Pariyantam Asmara Vande Guru Paramparam. Good. I noticed quite a few of you didn't make it in time for the meditation. Would it be better if we change the time of this class to 7:45? Should we consider? It's really important to be here for the meditation, so maybe after class, if a few of you want to come up and offer your suggestions, because with today's class, I think it needs to be just a little bit louder. Thank you. With today's class, the subject matter we enter into is so intimately tied to our experience. It's fine, thank you. That the meditation, if we fail to meditate before the class, we're going to enter the class like a college classroom and listen with the ears of a student. And we've discussed here several times, if you listen with the ears of a student, you're wasting your time, absolutely wasting your time. And we're so well trained, and pardon me for going back to a discussion we had perhaps in the first or second class, we're so well trained to listen for information. We're well trained to acquire information. And almost everyone enters into a class like that, like this, with that very orientation to acquire information. And that's exactly the orientation that will destroy the usefulness of this class. This class is about your experience. This class is about the experience you're having right now, this very moment. And the purpose of that meditation is to help us shift our orientation away from this worldly attitude of grasping for information and to focus very much on our own experience. Anyway, after class we can have a discussion about whether or not we should shift our class to 7:45. Maybe it'll solve the problem. And today's class, our subject matter is, we'll pick up where we left off in the last class and move forward. And what we're seeing in this next series of verses is, as far as I can tell, one of the most brilliant unfoldments of the nature of the relationship between consciousness and your experience as an individual person. This is a topic that is generally not explained in some detail. You know, you've heard 1,000 times the statement that Atma Swarupa, your true nature, is consciousness, and then the next breath, you'll hear it said that, you know, you're independent, that consciousness is independent of your body, mind, and senses. This you've heard 1,000 times, and it still hasn't gone in. And the reason it hasn't gone in is you have been unable to connect it to your experience. What this text does is it proceeds with such care and such clarity that you have an opportunity to make that connection to your experience. If you can, what you're going to find is a startling and remarkable shift of your worldview, the way you understand yourself, the way you understand other people in the world. It is earth-shattering is a much overused word, but it's that kind of teaching. If you get it, it's absolutely remarkable, the kind of shift that occurs. Okay, so the best way to proceed is we started with this verse 6. We saw only the opening line. We want to review that opening line and then proceed in the next subject matter. Chit chaya veshato buddhau Chichaya Veshato Buddhau Bhanam Dhistu Dvidhastata Bhanam Dhistu Vidhat Ekahang Kritaranyasyad Ekahang Kritaranya Antahkarana Rupani Antahkarana Rupani. The first line we discussed in a prior class, Chichaya Aveshataha Buddhau. Buddhau, it should be da, double. Yeah, that's a typo. Buddhau. Buddhau, in the buddhi, there is bhanam, an appearance. An appearance of what? Chit chaya, the manifestation or reflection of chit, consciousness, having, because aveshataha, because it has entered into your mind, because it's present in the mind. These words are very abstract. We're going to return briefly to the two primary prakriyas, methodologies that we use to understand the relationship between consciousness and mind. This is one of the most vital teachings of Advaita Vedanta, because this is, when you hear, you are consciousness, you're not your body, mind, senses, the key to getting it experientially is what we're about to discuss and review what we saw in the last class. Remember those two prakriyas? I hope you remember. I maybe even wrote them down. It's worth remembering the terminology. One was pratibimbavada. The other was avachedavada. These, I don't want to get too scholarly on you, but a little scholarship goes a long way. This stuff is absolutely essential. Let's just remember what these two methodologies meant. Would someone please turn on the light? Thank you. And we especially want to connect this to our experience. So pratibimbavada, I'll stay with all Roman letters. Pratibimba means reflection. And this is a method of understanding our experience in that there is consciousness which is reflected. Actually, let's take the drishtanta first. Light shines on a bucket of water and is reflected from that bucket of water. In this drishtanta, in this metaphor, light, the light falling on a bucket represents consciousness. In particular, Sakshi Chaitanya. And we have to, at this point, develop a pretty significant vocabulary of technical terms. If I go on using too much English, the English terms don't have the precision. The word consciousness doesn't have the precision of the term Sakshi Chaitanya, which means literally witness consciousness. The consciousness that illumines the activity of your mind. Whatever is happening in your mind right now in this class at this moment, those activities are present in consciousness, illumined by consciousness, aveshataha. That consciousness, aveshataha, having entered into your mind, being present in your mind, shining in your mind, that consciousness reveals all your mental activities. Whatever is happening in your mind now is known. How? That's what we're explaining. How is this experience known? It is present in consciousness. It is revealed by consciousness. So the surface of the water in the bucket, all the waves in that water represent vrittis, thoughts, mental transformations, mental actions, we'll call them. And they are revealed by Sakshi Chaitanya, that is, the light of awareness shines upon those waves occurring in your mind, and that light is reflected. Now, that reflection in this verse is called Chit Chaya, which literally means reflection of consciousness, which is absolutely accurate. This is, remember a physics class about incident light and reflected light? This is what it is. So the term reflected is absolutely correct. Chaya here means reflection. It can also mean shadow. Here it means reflection. But that technical term covers up something that's too close to us. Reflected consciousness means what? It means this experience. Whatever you're experiencing right now, the room around you, your own body, whatever is happening in your mind, this is a very complicated experience. This experience is the result of consciousness illumining the activities of your mind, the vrittis, the waves represent the vrittis. So therefore, something I would like you to consider in terms of your experience right now is that this reflected consciousness also, it is chit-chai, it is lit, that's what it is. It happens to be a reflection of consciousness. But in a more experiential term, it's exactly what we mean by experience. Anubhava means experience. It is experience. Experience is not a thing, is it? Is it an object? 10 pounds of experience? Experience is what's happening now. Experience is this consciousness reflected by the activities of your mind. Now, is this a little bit complicated, perhaps? But this teaching gives you an opportunity to discern what goes on in experience. The most fundamental aspect of human existence is experience. Suppose someone asks you, what is it? What is experience? Well, here you have a brilliant, detailed way of understanding what is experience. Consciousness, witness consciousness, is reflected by the activities of your mind, and that reflection, chit-chaya, that reflected consciousness, is what we mean by experience. This is one of two metaphors we introduced in the last class, one of two main prakriya. Prakriya means teaching methodology. One of two main prakriyas that we use to understand the relationship between mind and consciousness. The second one was avicchedavada. Avicchedavada means limitation. And in that second example, I gotta think of, I wanna give a better picture of this. Suppose you're thinking about a chair. That chair is a vritti in your mind. The chair out here is made of fabric and wood. What is the chair in here made of? What is its content? Huh? Well, we saw here that chit-chaya aveshataha, that this consciousness is manifest, aveshataha, it's manifest in your mind, it's present in your mind. What is present inside in buddhi is that consciousness. So, the content, the chair in your mind is made of consciousness. It has consciousness as its content, chair as its form. And the metaphor we gave in the last class, if there's water, there's waves in that water. Suppose one of the waves, this is where it gets really silly, one of the waves takes the form of a chair. How's this? So one of the waves takes the form of a chair. We've just described vritti. What is a vritti? Vritti is any mental activity can be called vritti. What is a vritti? What is a mental activity? It is consciousness with some form superimposed on it. When you see a chair, in your mind is a vritti whose form is chair, whose content is consciousness. You with me? This is really important. Right now, if you're looking at me, in your mind is this little Swami. In your mind, the form is this form. The content is consciousness. Avacheda-vada explains our experience by saying consciousness gets limited by a form. A form is superimposed on consciousness, just like formless water is conditioned by the shape of the wave. In the same way, formless consciousness is conditioned or limited by whatever object, mental object, is present. So avacheda-vada is the second. Notice these are two different ways of understanding our experience right now. One is more from the standpoint of you, the observer. That is, this, you know, as human beings, this is something we can relate to, because all the time we know light shines on objects, light reveals objects, light reveals everything in the room, so we can relate to this in terms of our experience. The light of consciousness, Sakshi Chaitanya, witness consciousness, illuminating the activities of our mind, and the result of that illumination is experience. This is what's usually taught in most Vedanta classes. Both of these are taught in Vedanta. Both of these are taught by Sri Shankaracharya. Both of these are important in Sri Shankaracharya's mind. This avacheda-vada is both neglected and more important, which is perhaps one of the reasons many people struggle with this material and with this understanding. Avacheda-vada is not from the standpoint of experience, but from the standpoint of reality. It asks the question, or it answers the question, what is a vritti? What is experience? And it answers, experience is nothing but consciousness, represented by the waves, consciousness with a particular form superimposed upon it. So it's less from the standpoint of our experience, more from the standpoint of what is a vritti. On the other hand, both of these accurately describe what's happening right now. This experience we're having, is it remote from consciousness or present in consciousness? This experience cannot be separate from consciousness. There's no such thing as an unconscious experience, right? Doesn't make any sense. Experience takes place in consciousness. Now, that seems like a very fundamental statement, but look what it's saying. Experience takes place in consciousness, and we can see that in both these metaphors very clearly. In avacheda-vada, experience takes place. The form is superimposed on consciousness. Experience takes place in consciousness. And here, in pratibimba-vada, a little bit trickier. Remember that science class decades ago? Incident light and reflected light? Incident light and reflected light are light, right? You have light coming in. You have light going out, photons coming in, photons going out, photons are photons, consciousness is consciousness. It's not that light, is it light shines on a bucket and sound reflects off the bucket? Light shines on a bucket, light is reflected from the bucket. Consciousness illumines your mind, and that reflected consciousness is this experience. Anubhava means experience. This experience is consciousness. And what both of these prakriyas show, experience is conditioned consciousness. They both show that. Experience, anubhava, is consciousness, sakshi chaitanya, just chaitanya, consciousness, with some kind of form superimposed on it. Now, these are fairly sophisticated teachings. As we said several times, this is not a beginning level class. This class presumes that you've had a moderate exposure to Vedantic teachings. But the biggest challenge is understanding all this in terms of our experience. Now, pause here just for 1 second before we leave this and move on to the next subject matter. This is the crucial junction. If you get on board the train right now, everything that will follow in the coming weeks is going to be brilliant and profound. If you fail to get on a train right now, if you're still standing on the platform, you miss the train, and everything that follows in the coming classes will be mere information and virtually useless. This is why I made a point about the meditation earlier, and that's why I'm making a huge point right now, because where the text moves on to the next subject matters is even more. It's all based on this. If you don't have the basis, if you don't have the foundation, and if everything that comes isn't going to work, isn't going to make sense. So I hope we've spent enough time. We've spent half the class, last class, on this. Now we've just spent a good part of today's class reviewing this extremely important manner of understanding what is experience. Good. And as you know, if you have questions, you can, I think on our next Sunday, you can join us for satsang. We'll take your questions at that time. All right. So we're ready, finally, to move on in our verse. This much we saw in the previous class, along with other material. Now we're ready to move on. Move on to understand what are those vrittis. Vrittis are represented in two ways. Either as the waves on the water, so to speak, or the form superimposed on the wave. These are two ways of understanding vritti. Vritti literally means a mental activity. Activity is the right word, because vritti literally means something that's moving, changing. So any mental activity is a vritti. Now, one thing that's really helpful to do is to analyze what kinds of vrittis are there. And we've been analyzing that for millennia, right? What kinds of thoughts, what kinds of emotions, what kinds of memories. So 2,000, 3,000 years ago, the early Vedantins were already starting to categorize different kinds of mental activities. And this comes up to modern times where psychologists and neuroscientists go on further categorizing all these kinds of mental activities. So we could start creating really, really complicated categories. Some of you are familiar with a very typical Vedantic fourfold category of manas, buddhi, citta, ahankara. Most of you have heard that. And I'm not going to go into the details of it because it's not what Sri Shankara gives in his text. He gives, in this text, the most simple way of categorizing thoughts, mental events. The most simple way of categorizing all vrittis is to put them not in four categories, not in eight categories or 24 categories, but Sri Shankara here puts them in two categories. Just two. He says, dhihi tu, dhi buddhi. Here it represents all mental activities. All those mental activities, dhihi, dvidha, stita, is twofold. These mental activities are twofold. What are those two kinds, two categories of mental activities? Eka, one of them, is ahankritihi. One of them is ahankara. Ahankriti is a synonym. Ego. And we're going to define ego very carefully in just a moment. Eka ahankritihi. One of those two categories is ego. Anya syat, and the other would happen to be, what is the other? Antakarana rupini. The other is in the form of all other aspects of mind. Antakarana is a common word for mind. It literally means inner instrument, and it's just commonly used to describe all these mental activities. Now, there is something very fundamental in this twofold distinction, which these words don't bring out, so allow me to help you. In Shankaracharya's introduction to the Brahma Sutra Bhasha, one of his most brilliant works, in fact, not just one of Shankara's most brilliant works, arguably one of the most brilliant works in philosophy in all traditions, East and West, one of the most brilliant works is Shankara's introduction to the Brahma Sutra. And he begins that introduction with this distinction. He observes that everything in the world falls into two categories. What do you think those two categories would be? Those two categories. Everything in the world falls into two categories. What are those two categories? Me and everything else. Those are the two categories. Every time, by the way, every time I say this, I just, inside, I'm laughing because I can hear my guru's voice. And when I first heard him in the 1980s, he had this very thick Tamilian accent. He still has a pretty much accent, but not as much as he had in those days. And I remember struggling with his accent in those days when he said, there are two things in the world, me and everything else. And I was really, it took me a while to figure that one out. Eventually I got it. All right. But that's very profound. Me and everything else. Let's use some more philosophical terms. Subject and object. Clear? Everything that exists is either subject, me, the knowing person, or object, an object of your experience. Everything is either, another way of categorizing it is one, maybe we should get some of this up here. So he uses the term in his verse, ahankriti. I'll use a more familiar term, ahankara, which is ego. And the other, he uses the term antakarana, which literally means mind. But the implication here, and this is what Shankara taught in his Brahma Sutra Bhasha introduction, is ahankara, ego, represents subject, and antakarana, mind, everything that happens in your mind is known to you. And as we said in an earlier class, everything that happens outside in the world is known to you in your mind. We even made the point that the only thing known to you, really speaking, the only thing directly known to you is the contents of your mind. The world outside is known indirectly. What is present in your mind is known directly. Therefore, the contents of your mind represents the entire world of objects. And this is the distinction he wishes to make. This is true not only outside in the world, this is true in your inner world as well, in terms of your own experience. Everything you experience is either, and this is where I was leading up to, everything you experience is either I or not I. What is it? There's no third category. Everything is either subject or object. Now let's make sure that we can relate this to our experience. Object makes sense, right? Well, I don't think we have to go into that. But this I, what are we talking about? Well, do you have a name? Who does that name belong to? Huh? Does the name belong to your body? Your body is a thing, right? You say, no, Swamiji, it's my name. The name belongs to me. That's the one we're talking about. That's a mental construction. We all have a self-concept, an idea of who we are. That idea of who we are is really complicated, right? I mean, we define ourselves, just to expand this a little bit, a nice way to expand this is with a sentence, I am, and then a blank. You can fit it in. How many things can you put in that blank? I am young, I am old, I am male, I am female, I'm strong, I'm weak, I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm this, I'm that. It'll just go on and on and on and on. All of that is part of our self-concept, ahankara, ego. So here, ego or ahankara is not in the sense of pride here. That's not at all what we mean. We mean ego in the very fundamental term that it is. And I mentioned in other classes, I'll mention here briefly, that ego happens to be the Latin pronoun I. In Latin, ego means I. Ahankara literally means that which creates I. Aham is the Sanskrit pronoun for I. So this is a little bit more sophisticated. Ego simply means I, but ahankara means that which creates I. What is it that creates I? Filling in the blank. I am Swami Tadatmananda. Fill in the blank, and you add one more aspect to this ahankara. So however you define yourself, identify yourself, whatever you think about yourself, your self-concept, and that's all part of ahankara. And not only that, but right now you're listening. Therefore, we could fill in the blank, I am a listener. You're the agent of an action. Right now you're thinking. I am a thinker. You are the agent of the action of thinking. Walking, talking. Life is action, activity. Who is the agent of all that activity? I am. What I? Is your body the agent of the activity? Your body is an instrument used in all that activity. But when you say, I did it, maine kiya, I did it. Who is that one who did it? That's ahankara, ego. That's our definition now of ego. And that's one of the two categories. So everything that happens in our mind is either subject or object. It's either part of our self-identity, our self-concept, ahankara, or it's not. If it's not, it's something like a thought. A thought is clearly an object. Emotions. Emotions are clearly mental objects. Anything you see, hear, taste, touch, or smell, objects of the senses. All of these are vishayas. Vishaya means object. All right. So, this is how our text defines vrittis in the most fundamental categorization possible, a twofold category. We could make 4 categories, 10 categories, dozens of categories. If you go into some, go get a psychology textbook on personality types. A psychology textbook on personality types could give you not several personality types, but dozens Dozens and dozens of different personality types, which means different ways of defining I. So, we're trying to be more simple than that. Just two categories. I and not I. Subject and object. All right, let's proceed. Chayahankarayorhaikyam. Chayahankarayorhaikyam. Taptaya pindavanmatam. Taptaya pindavanmatam. Tarahankara taratmyat. Tarahankara taratmyat. Dehaschetanatam agat. Dehaschetanatam agat. Good. This ego, which is what we're talking about in the next three verses, this verse and the next two verses, you will find one of the most clear definitions of what is ahankara and how does it work. And what it's actually, it's a fairly remarkable text. And to do it in a short span of three verses is a trick. So, and you'll see some of the tricks employed to do it so briefly. So, suppose we want to understand how this ahankara functions. Its functioning is I am, fill in the blank, which means various things get associated with I. Various things are used to define I. Body is used to define I. The attributes of the body are used to define I. Not only that, the attributes of my mind and emotions, I'm happy, I'm sad, all of these are used to define I. Tell me, am I am, fill in the blank, I am jada or chetana? I am insentient or sentient? Huh. I am unconscious or conscious? Well, that's one more factor. In addition to I am male, female, I'm short, tall, I'm young, old, all of this stuff, in addition to all of those factors, I also define myself. We define ourselves as conscious, sentient, which means it's one more identification of the ego, one more factor that we use to label ourselves, identify ourselves. But this one turns out to be crucial. We'll see as we proceed. Before we proceed, we have to come back to our avichedavada and pratibimbavada. This ahankara that we've defined, the self-definition, self-concept, is it a vritti or not? Vritti? Really? Where does it occur? If you're answering this question, I am, and fill in the blank, where does that sentence take place? In your mind? Where do thoughts take place? In your mind? Where do all mental activities take place in your mind? This self-concept, where do concepts take place? Your concept of love, nice. Where does that take place? In your physical heart? Your concept of love takes place in your mind. Really speaking, your emotion of love also takes place in your mind. Everything takes place in your mind. Therefore, your concept of who you are occurs where? In your mind. Your definition of who you are, your sense of being who you are, sense of individuality is a term you've heard me use many times for ahankara. that sense of individuality, like any other sense, it all takes place in your mind. The prior verse, the text said, there are two kinds of vrittis. We're talking about vritti. We're not talking about you. We're talking about mental activities. He said, dhihi tu dvidha stita. Dhihi, mental activities, are dvidha, are twofold. Half, some of those mental activities deal with objects. Some of those mental activities deal with you. Got it? So this ahankara is another collection of vrittis, mental events. Where do you fit into the picture? The real you? Well, if ahankara is a vritti, it's an activity going on in your mind, a mental activity, like any vritti. Tell me, is that ahankara illumined or not? Like any other mental activity, it's illumined. Your ahankara is illumined by sakshi chaitanya, by witness consciousness, which means your ahankara must be present in your experience right now. Tell me, do you feel like yourself? What a weird question. Do you feel like an individual person? Yes, of course. By the way, we should point out that you don't always have that sensation. In dreamless sleep, do you feel like an individual person? In dreamless sleep, that vritti goes away. Remember, though, we've already established two classes ago that in dreamless sleep, you're absolutely conscious. So in dreamless sleep, the surface of the water becomes flat. No vrittis, no movement whatsoever. Consciousness reflected on a quiet mind still gives experience. Very silent, that's the experience of pure silence. The point I'm making is that you experience the presence and absence of ahankara. It's a vritti like any other vritti. It comes and goes. It's illumined by consciousness. It's present in your experience right now. If we look at it from the standpoint of avichedavada, this experience we're having right now is a really complicated experience. It includes many objects and it includes a subject. The many objects it includes, everything that we're seeing, hearing right now in this hall, are all part of the present experience. But part of this experience is also you, the listener, you, the thinker. So objects are present in this experience. The subject is also present in this experience. Imagine all of this superimposed on water, creating a really complicated waveform. That's what it is. The point then is that ahankara is present in this experience, but that ahankara is a vritti. It's not you. Now, this isn't in the text, but I guess it's really important to bring out this point right now. Our failure to recognize the ahankara as a vritti is at the root of all suffering. This is not in the text. The text doesn't get into this. The text presumes it's already so obvious to you. It might not be. So let's go into this a little bit right now. Where the text is going is, to use modern language, deconstructing the ahankara is what's going to take place in this verse and the next two verses. But we should ask the question, what is the value of deconstructing the ahankara? And what I'd like to share with you now, I've just kind of reshaped the whole class. I thought we were going to see this verse and two more. We're not going to. It's okay. This is such fundamental Vedantic teachings that we can't skip over this. To have a vritti called ahankara that says, I am such and such and so and so. On the surface, it seems, well, of course, no big deal. It is a big deal. It's an extremely big deal. Watch what happens. When I fill in the blank, I am an embodied person. I dwell in this body. This body is my residence. This is my body. That kind of ahankara, that aspect of ahankara. I become then identified with the body. It's not a body. It is my body. This is the natural identification that takes place due to ahankara. Because when you put in, when you fill in a blank, I am the owner of this body, I'm the indweller of this body, etc., etc. I am an embodied person. So that identification takes place with the body. That would seem to be very normal and ordinary, but reflect on this. When the body is ill, the illness belongs to the body, does it not? Does illness belong to ahankara? Ahankara is a thought. Illness belongs not to a thought. Illness belongs to the body. But when we're ill, do you say, oh, my body is ill? I am ill. I'm sick. Now that's very curious. The illness really belongs to the body. You've just associated it with your ego, ahankara. And when you say, I am sick, is that pleasant? It's miserable. Now, look at the difference of these two. If you could say, my body has illness, if the illness truly belongs to the body, and if it doesn't belong to your sense of self, if the illness belongs to the body, it's a fact to be dealt with, just like any other fact in life, just one more thing in the world. But when you say, I am ill, it is very personal, right? And personal means threatening. And just to make this very clear, I'll just give my stock example. A few of you have heard in other classes. In the parking lot, if somebody else's car is dented, it's not a big deal, right? Just another car that got nailed in the parking lot. Okay, it happens. But when your car has the new dent, it's a big deal. It's just a car. Besides, the dent belongs to whom? You or the car? People get so upset, you'd think they got dented and not the car. Look at this. If somebody else's car is dented, really, you could care less because there's no identification with it. Suppose you could have that same relationship with your own car. After all, it's just a thing. And you can. That's not a big deal. It's just my car. Okay, car got a dent. I'll call the insurance and we'll get it fixed, etc., etc. It's just a factual situation. It's not a problem that makes you suffer. But that's generally not what happens, right? It's my car. Who hit my car? What idiot did it? And then he left without leaving a note. And you get very upset and you suffer. Look at the difference. If it's just a car that got dented, if the dent belongs to the car, it's no problem. It's just a fact. It's just a situation. If the dent belongs to you, it's a problem and you suffer. Really speaking, all suffering arises in this manner. All suffering arises in this manner. we take upon ourselves all things that don't belong to us. We identify with all things and we suffer as a result. So let's be more specific. If my body has some illness, I then identify myself with the body. Therefore, it's not the body's illness, it's my illness. If the body has illness, I should take it to a doctor and take care of it. It's just a situation. But if I have illness, I suffer. I worry. I fret. I'm miserable. Mind also. If you get this one, this is one of the most amazing teachings. Sadness is a very common vritti, is it not? All too common. We wish happiness would be there more, but sometimes sadness is there quite a bit. All right. Sadness is a vritti. Vritti is in the mind. Sadness belongs, what a funny question. To whom does sadness belong? Does sadness belong to your body? Does sadness belong to your senses? Sadness belongs to your mind, does it not? Sadness belongs to your mind. Just like illness belongs to your body, sadness belongs to your mind. Is that how it seems to you? When you're crying and someone says, "Are you okay?" He says, "I'm okay, but my mind is sad." Never. That's the point. If sadness is merely another vritti, it's no big deal. It's just another vritti. It's another mental event. It comes, it goes, like any other vritti, like any other situation in life. It's a fact and not a problem. It's my guru's language. He likes that kind of language. Sadness is a fact. But it becomes a problem when you associate sadness with ahankara by filling in the blank, "I am sad." The sadness doesn't belong to ahankara, doesn't belong to you. The sadness belongs to your mind. If you could disassociate yourself from the sadness would just be a fact. When you fail to make that distinction, sadness becomes a problem and you suffer. So we could go on at length about this. This is the kind of material that we really deal more in our Mahabharata class. So we'll leave it here. We could go on for class after class after class talking about this subject. As I said, it's not in the text, but I thought it was important to bring it in right now to understand that this ahankara's identification with various vrittis is at the root of all suffering. Notice I was very careful in my choice of words. Did I say it was a cause for all suffering? I didn't say that. I said it's at the root. There is a cause, which is one layer deeper. You have to be patient and we'll get there. It's not the ultimate cause. We're almost there, but not quite there. Okay, let's return to our text now. We have this tendency of the ahankara to identify itself with all kinds of things. The ahankara identifies itself with the body. When you say, "I am," if I say, "I am male, I am X years old," etc., etc., we're identifying with the body. We can identify with the mind, etc. So this identification takes place with body, mind, etc. But we also say, "I'm a conscious being. I am conscious. I'm sentient. I am chetana." That's not exactly what the text says. The language is a little tricky here. chaya ahankara yoho aikyam. There is aikyam, oneness means identification. Aikyam literally means oneness, but in our context, identification. Identification of what? Identification of ahankara, ego. And what does the ahankara get identified with? That it says chaya, reflected consciousness, but the language here will throw you off base. Chaya means reflected consciousness, but now we're getting really abstract. Come over here. Chaya means reflected consciousness, but what did we say reflected consciousness is? Experience. We get identified with our experiences. Ego gets identified with experience. I experience my body, I get identified with it. I experience sadness, I get identified with it. I experience happiness, I get identified. I experience tiredness, I get identified with it. Whatever happens in my experience, I think it's happening to me. Whatever's in your experience, doesn't it feel like it's happening to you? Of course. The reality is, it's happening to your mind. It's occurring in your mind. But whatever occurs in your mind happens to be illumined by consciousness. But that's not how we interpret it. We interpret that this experience is happening to me. And what we're about to do is to try to get you to shift your orientation. So instead of saying, this experience is happening to me, you can say, this experience is known to me. Those are hugely different perspectives. Generally, whatever we experience is happening to me. When you stub your toe and it's throbbing like anything, it's happening to you, right? But suppose you could shift your perspective so that pain was present in your awareness. If pain, a vritti in the form of a throbbing toe, is present in your awareness, then it's just another fact. It's just another situation. It's not a problem. It's not something that threatens you. It's not something that causes suffering. There's a powerful, powerful metaphor here that's used to separate out the two factors in experience. And now we're going to draw more on this avicheda-vada. So let's return to this and understand. So right now, just for fun, suppose you have a headache. I hope none of you do. I hope you're all feeling very good. But suppose right now you have a throbbing headache after listening to the Swami going on and on and on. Could make you have a headache, perhaps. Suppose you have a headache. That's your experience of the moment. That headache is a vritti. It's an experience. It's one of these objects. And that object is definitely going to be present in your consciousness, part of the form superimposed on this wave. Now, problem is that it got identified with I. It becomes my headache. Suppose we could find some way of separating these two things out, so that it's not my headache, it's a headache. It's pain present in my head. Pain present in this head, even better. Pain present in this head. Notice if it's my headache, I suffer. If it's pain present in this head, it's a fact. I can still take Tylenol. If it's a fact, then deal with it like a fact. Take some Tylenol and lay down. But the problem is that headache and I are so intertwined. And that's what it says. Chaya ahankara yoho aikyam. There's oneness, there's identification of ahankara, I, with everything you experience, including the headache. And notice, weird questions are coming up tonight. What is the distance between experience and consciousness? What is the distance between headache and consciousness? There's no distance. What is the distance between the form of a wave and water? What is the distance between wave and water? There's no distance. Sure leads to confusion when there's no distance between two things. Obviously, they get confused, but they're two different things. Wave and water are not synonyms, are they? Pot and clay are not synonyms, are they? One is form, one is content. Theoretically, we should be able to differentiate between pot form and clay substance, between wave form and water substance, between vritti form and consciousness substance. But they're so closely together, and they give, text gives us brilliant traditional metaphor to explain the oneness or identification of ego, ahankara, and experience. The analogy, tapta ayaha. Ayas, ayas is a Sanskrit word for iron. Ayas. Tapta ayas, heated iron. Back in the old days, they were ironsmiths, metalsmiths, blacksmiths, and they had to work that iron. What would they do? They'd put that iron in a furnace, and they would fire up that furnace until that iron was tapta, heated, but not just heated, glowing red. In fact, red-orange, really bright. When you see that pinda means ball, so an ayas pinda, a ball of iron glowing orange-red, looks like a ball of fire. It's not a ball of fire. What is the relationship between fire and iron? They're two different things, right? They're two completely different things. You have an ayas pinda, a ball of fire, and you have a ball of iron, excuse me, and there's also tapta, heat, or in this case, fire. They're two different things, but when you see that glowing red ball, do you see two different things? This is aikyam, oneness. This is identification. And now we have to introduce a really important teaching about how this aikyam takes place. How can oneness take place between two different things? Can there be oneness between an apple and an orange? They're two different things. Can there be oneness between a wave and water? Really speaking, they're two different things. But they get combined. Can there be oneness between pot and clay? They're two different things, but they get connected together. Let's talk about that connection. Two utterly different things. Pot is an idea. Clay is a substance. Utterly different things end up looking like one, but they're utterly different. That process takes place due to adhyasa superimposition. And this is our topic for this verse and the next two verses. So let's introduce this topic properly. The topic is adhyasa superimposition. And since this is not a beginner's class, we can even be a little bit more technical and say anyonya adhyasa. First, adhyasa means superimposition. Superimposition means one thing is superimposed on another. For example, in the case of the pot, pot is superimposed on clay. If you ask, what is it? The substance is nothing but clay, but that pot gets superimposed on it. The pot is an idea or a concept which is not identical with clay. They're really two different things, but due to superimposition, pot is superimposed on clay. We call that clay pot. This is the idea of adhyasa, superimposition. In the case of the iron ball, you see that glowing piece of fire. It looks like a fiery ball. It looks like a ball of fire. Imagine a piece of iron, 2 inches across, glowing orange, maybe little flames coming out of it. You'd say it's a ball. You would experience it as a ball of fire. It's not. What happens is fire is superimposed upon the ball. All right? Now, it's also a case of anyonya adhyasa. Anyonya means mutual. It actually comes in an odd way. Anya, anya. Different, different. Due to some grammar rules, it becomes anyonya. Different, different. So not only, in the case of the iron ball, you have superimposed fire. Fire is superimposed on the ball. It's really a ball of iron, but you don't see it as a ball of iron. You say it's a ball of fire. So fire has been superimposed on the iron ball, but it works both ways. It's mutual superimposition, which means in some sense, ball is not only is fire superimposed on ball, but ball is superimposed on fire. In what sense? What is a form of fire? It has no form. So you superimpose ballness on fire. This is the reverse superimposition. So that which belongs to the fire gets superimposed on ball. That which belongs to the ball gets superimposed on fire. So that which, ball is, iron ball is iron ball, but when you say it's a fiery ball, then fire, the attribute of fire is superimposed on an iron ball. Iron balls don't have that attribute of fire. Similarly, fire is formless, but the ballness of the iron is superimposed on the fire. So this is what we mean by anyonya, adhyasa, mutual superimposition. This is the drishtanta, the metaphor, now the darshtanta, that which the metaphor is intended to show. We're talking about the relationship between ahankara and chit-chaya, the relationship between ego and experience. The fact that whatever is, again, fancy philosophical terms, let's make sure that we get it in experience. This experience is happening to you, right? That's your experience. But there are two things present right now which have become identified with each other through this mutual superimposition, just like fire and the iron ball. In this case, this experience is present in consciousness. This experience is a form superimposed on consciousness. Just as the iron ball is superimposed on fire, in the same way, this experience is superimposed on consciousness. There's mutual superimposition going on in terms of this experience. Let's see if we can put it in some very clear terms, experiential terms. Consciousness has no attributes. Consciousness has no edge, no boundary. Consciousness is limitless, all-pervasive. We've had this discussion before. Is that your experience right now? This experience is consciousness. After all, what is experience? Experience is consciousness. Whether you look at it from Pratibimbavada or Avichedavada, consciousness is experience. I'm sorry, said it backwards. Experience is consciousness. This experience is consciousness. Consciousness happens to be all-pervasive. Is all-pervasiveness present in this experience? Something with limitations has been superimposed on consciousness right now. That's what Avichedavada says. That in spite of the fact that consciousness is all-pervasive, vast, boundaryless, we experience it as being limited. Why? Because of the way our minds work? That's exactly, this describes a vritti, the way our mind works. The way our minds work is they connect experience and consciousness. We then end up with what appears to be limitless, limited consciousness. Just like fire appears to be limited to the ball. In fact, the fire has no form. Anyonya adhyasa, mutual. Let's look at the other way. Vrittis are objects, aren't they? But this experience is happening to me, to you. It's something that's happening in a very personal way. It's affecting you. This experience is not separate from you. This experience seems to be happening to you. This is the result of the other side of the superimposition. Just as experience is superimposed on consciousness is superimposed on experience. An experience which is really in your mind seems like it's happening to you. Now, we're not going to go further in the text. So let me, in the last few minutes of the class, try to suggest some ways of bringing this more to an experiential way of understanding. A lot of this can sound, especially if you're hearing this for the first time, and some of you may be hearing this for the first time, these teachings at first seem a little complicated or even intimidating. What it is an attempt to help us understand our own experiences in the light of truth. We've said from the beginning of this class that our experiences mislead us again and again and again. In fact, all of Vedanta could be described as a process of re-examining our experiences and learning where they've tricked us and led us to suffering. We're now looking at experience in the most fundamental way possible. When we begin this kind of discussion, it often sounds theoretical and philosophical. And the reason for it, perhaps, is this is a topic for another lecture. So let me say it very briefly. We don't understand what's going on in our own minds. We had in our Mahabharata class, we had a wonderful chapter we just finished on self-observation. We don't know. We have experiences, but we don't understand them. Vrittis are going through our minds every moment of every day. We're clueless. A good example is people have emotions, and have no idea why they feel the way they feel. I'm angry. I don't know why I'm angry. I'm hurt. I don't know why I should be so hurt. It's not a big deal. We have emotions that confuse us. We have thoughts. Where did that thought come from? We are, in some sense, unfamiliar with our own mental landscape. And to the extent that our mental landscapes are unfamiliar to us, how is any of this going to make sense? This brings us to the opening comment of this class. This is where meditation becomes absolutely essential. One of the most profound benefits of meditation is becoming familiar with the mental landscape. Identifying what are thoughts, what are emotions, what are sensations, and being able to see them in your own experience, see them very clearly, very distinctly. I'll share something interesting with you. When you become an experienced meditator, you can even observe your own ego coming and going. It's remarkable to actually see that sense of individuality, that sense of being a person, that sense of I-ness. And in an experienced meditator, you can watch it come and go. You can invite its return. You can send it away. You can control your thoughts to some extent right now, right? So imagine if you became an experienced meditator and could even manipulate your own ahankara as you could manipulate other thoughts, you really gain such tremendous insight into the nature of mind. So to wrap up tonight's class, I want to end by encouraging all of you to be very dedicated to a practice of meditation. In my view, this kind of class material, in the absence of meditation, is utterly worthless. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. And I've learned the hard way. I've been teaching this material for a long time, and I see that it often doesn't work. And my gut feeling is one of the main reasons it doesn't work is lack of meditation. Meditation is the place where you really understand what is a thought. What is a vritti? And there's no better way to gain that fundamental understanding than meditation. Okay. Well, we'll wrap up our class right now. I hope you'll take it to heart, though, about the need for meditation and need also, again, after the class, maybe we can, a few of you want to come talk to me if we need the change of time of the class to 7:45. We'll do it because the meditation is that important. So we will have that discussion after class. We won't take action yet. When we meet next week, then, we'll continue with this text and talk about the way that this ahankara gets identified with various things. It's a very, very profound subject. We'll conclude with our prayers.